Good morning. Welcome to the Sixth Circuit. It's great to have everyone here in person. The clerk may call the first case.
Case number 19-2433, Solon, Missouri versus USA. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Snyder for the appellant.
Morning, Judge Gethledge, and may it please the court.
Morning.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
In large part, this appeal concerns just how big a mountain to make out of this particular molehill. At bottom, this is a simple case. My client was held in his prison secure housing unit for the entire time that he had to file his notice of appeal. When he emerged from the hole, so to speak, he asked the district court to grant him a time extension to file that notice. And the district court surprisingly denied that request. He now wishes to appeal that denial.
How do we know he was in the SHU the entire time? Because the government takes issue with that.
Yes, I mean, to be clear, and I did point this out in the briefs, the specific documentation that he was in the SHU in terms of the prison record was filed with his notice of appeal with respect to this order, not with respect to his motion for extension of time. However, in his motion for extension of time, he did inform the court that he was in the secure housing unit and that as a result, he wasn't able to file a notice of appeal.
He said to the district court he was in the secure housing unit at the federal correctional institution when the order came down.
That's correct.
Yeah, so I don't think the district court, as the government says, has to construe. I agree with you on the appeal, but I'm trying to figure out if he abused his discretion.
Sure. I mean, to begin with, there's an easy way out if you think that the facts are more complicated, which is that at this point, there's essentially no question that the district court applied the wrong standard. Before 2002, when the rules were amended, there was a circuit split as to whether or not good cause constituted a reason to extend time. This court happened to be on the wrong side of the split in terms of what the Rules Committee eventually did. Now it is clear the good cause is
which rule was that? The appellate rule?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need to have piecemeal rounds of litigation over this notice of appeal business. I mean, I know where you're going with it. I mean, he did say in paragraph 5 of his motion, I mean, the definite article is just sort of throughout this case. And it says he was denied access to postage stamps during the time in which he was required to file his notice of appeal.
So I agree.
Anything to say about that?
My view of that is fairly read, that the motion made clear that the reason why he was not able to file the notice of appeal was because he was confined in a special housing unit without access to stamps, library, and other research material.
Let me bring up in response to that the government's other argument, which is that the complaint wasn't verified and he didn't file it under a penalty of perjury. What do we do with that? I know what you said in your reply brief, but if that they didn't point to authority, but I mean, what do we do with that argument? Do we just say they didn't point to authority? So
I'm just aware of no authority that requires such extensive documentation when asking for a time extension. I mean, certainly if this were, I mean, I'm not talking about notice of appeal, but you know, in ordinary civil litigation, it's routine for people to ask for extensions. Ms. Cohen and I both asked and thankfully got extensions in this case. And if you read the actual motions papers that he filed, fairly read, they make clear that the reason he couldn't file the notice of appeal is because he was in the SHU. I believe that constitutes an abuse of discretion on the facts. I don't think you need to vacate and let the court reconsider it under the standard, but I do think that standard was incomplete.
Can I move you to the standard? Because your proposed test, which I know you get from Harbison, is that there's one final order in essence. How do we deal with SLAC then, which talks about procedural rulings needing a COA?
Yes. I mean, to begin with, SLAC is in Harbison, right? I mean, it's cited in that case, so it's evident that the Supreme Court was aware of that issue. Two points to make. First point is that at bare minimum, the SLAC order, an order denying a habeas petition on procedural default, can be characterized as an order disposing of the merits. I think actually that's the only...
Really disposing of the merits? It's like a forfeiture.
I might agree with you, Judge LaPar, on first principles. All I'll say is that, again, SLAC is in Harbison. So following the sentence where they say that the order needs to dispose of the merits, they cite the Slack versus McDaniels. I think the only way to square that circle is to view that as the Supreme Court saying that, look, when the district court denies the habeas petition, it's disposing the merits. That's...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Speaking for myself, it doesn't strike me as a strange use of the word dispose. I mean, it's disposing of the merits, not necessarily on the merits, but it's getting rid of them.
Yes.
In the sense that the court no longer must deal with them. It's
Correct.
Dealt with them, albeit in kind of an oblique way, I suppose.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, Judge Gethledge, the only thing I'll point out is, and we can talk about the Rule 60 issue, there are other senses in which an order might dispose of the merits, perhaps if the district court needed to consider the merits in order to rule on a Rule 60 motion. But the
sure.
point I want to make is, whatever sense you think that Harbison was using the term merits and dispose of the merits, it is nearly impossible to construct a sentence that begins with this order denied a time extension and ends with this order disposed of the merits
so,
of the habeas petition.
Wait, but I want to know where the line is. And so you just indicated Rule 60. Would 60 be on the merits or not?
So it depends. First of all, I think the court should probably not weigh into that. I will explain why. I think you
second
should.
Petition, typically, if you're seeking to revisit, at least in a 2254 case, if you're trying to revisit the district court judgment that is determining whether the person is held in custody pursuant to a state court judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
So a lot of times it's just a second petition.
I agree. And so that's what I was going to say. In terms of categorizing the various types of Rule 60 motions, because I think the analysis could depend on the type, as you point out, the easiest type is going to be a second or successive petition, what you know, sometimes are called false Rule 60 motions.
Yep.
Those do require, of course, authorization from the Court of Appeals. But when they get back to the district court and the district court denies it, I think there's no question that that kind of order would require a COA because it's, in essence, asking the district.
It's treated just like a petition.
Yes.
You know.
So that one's
maybe
easy.
You get permission to file it, but.
That one's easy, but not
I mean,
all
we've
of
had
them
that. Judge Batchelder and I had one of those cases, capital case.
Those are easy. More difficult are ones that ask for relief for the from the judgment from other grounds, perhaps on the grounds of fraud. However, I think if you want a test that I think doesn't end up, that makes sense of nearly all the case law in this area, it's clear that the Rule 60 motion, if granted, would have an effect on the judgment denying the habeas petition, right? I mean, if you were asking for relief.
So it would be on the merits.
So it would be on the merits.
Yeah, otherwise the exception is going to swallow the rule ultimately.
Yes.
What do we do? I mean, so the statute says the final order in the case. And you're saying, okay, that must be an order that in some manner disposes of the merits in the case. What if the district court disposes of the merits, say, in like two different orders? In two different orders. I mean, it's just conceivable to me that, you know, particularly in a case where the guy has like 20-odd claims or something, maybe, you know, the court gets rid of most of them in one order, but then for some reason addresses one or two in a later order. Which one is the final order? Or what do you think the court, what happens then?
I think the way to deal with that is to characterize both of those orders as resolving separate habeas proceedings. This is, I know it's a little complicated, this actually is the tack that the Third Circuit has taken.
Wait, what do you mean resolving separate habeas proceedings? In the same case?
Yes. So the Third Circuit view, they actually apply that to Rule 60 motions. They say their view, oh, Your Honor, sorry.
Wait, but why isn't the answer you appeal judgments, not orders, and so the final order is the judgment, and so it would encompass both?
I took Judge Kethledge's hypothetical to involve two different judgments. If it's just one judgment, then...
No, there wouldn't be two. No, I don't think that is likely to occur. So
okay.
I think actually Judge Thapar has answered my question for you.
In that case, it's easy, right? You got a final judgment. The rule is you get to appeal all previous orders entered before a final judgment.
Yeah, I mean, usually there's going to be a judgment at the end.
Yes.
And that's what is appealed. And there was, well, there wasn't a judgment here.
There's
just the order.
There's the judgment denying the habeas petition.
There was a judgment
denying the habeas
petition. Opposed to an order?
That's right. There was a judgment.
Okay.
All right. You mean the underlying one going to whether or not he got a hearing and then saying the ineffective assistance claim was not meritorious?
Correct.
Did he raise this IAC claim on direct appeal, correct?
He did.
All right, and we told him, no, bring it on a 2255.
That's right.
Okay.
And then he raised it in 2255. It was denied. Obviously, he filed the time extension motion, and that's what he wants
to
do.
Yeah, right.
In terms of practical effects, I mean, just to spell this out a little bit, I mean, the purpose of the AEDPA statute is to reduce the work of courts, particular courts of appeals, dealing with habeas cases. I think there's no question that the easiest way to resolve this, the least work, is to go straight to the merits. I don't think there's any doctrinal reasons to spin up the COA machinery here, and I suggest that you don't do so.
Is your time running out?
It's out.
Okay.
I reserve the rest of my time
for
rebuttal.
You'll have your time. We'll hear from Ms. Cohen.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nicola Cohen on behalf of the United States. Under the plain text of Section 2253C, petitioner must obtain a COA to appeal the order denying his Rule 4A5 motion. This order is the final order entered in petitioner's Section 2253.
But it's not just about sort of chronology. I mean, final order is very much a term of art in this context. So, I mean, would you agree that this is not a matter of chronology in terms of what did the district court happen to enter last on its docket?
We don't, Your Honor.
You don't
that's
agree
because
with that.
Here we believe that this order is the final order because it is the last order entered in petitioner's Section 2255 proceedings.
I mean, the government, on the other hand, analogizes this to 1291's use of final what? Is it again?
It does say final decision, Your Honor.
Right. But we don't construe 1291 to mean that a final decision is like the last one, right? I mean, it's a term of art relating to whether there remains any work for the district court to do after entry of the order, right?
And that is what we believe we have here.
But that refutes the idea, if you want to carry that analogy to this statute, that this is a matter of chronology as opposed to a matter of whether the order disposes of the merits of the case.
Several points. So first, I believe that this is the final order, as I said, because it's the last order entered. It's the only order that petitioner can even appeal. It leaves nothing pending before the district court, and it disassociates the district court from the case entirely. But second,
it is a 1291 final order, I'll grant you that.
So what we believe Harbison...
do you think it's on the merits as understood in Harbison?
What we understand Harbison to say when it says that the final order must dispose of the merits of a proceeding is that it must have the effect of concluding the proceedings altogether.
What is the impact of Judge Sutton's new language in Pouncey where he talks about separate from the merits? What does that mean?
I don't believe that's not what we took, Your Honor, from Pouncey. Pouncey, we believe, is consistent with our position here, that an order denying the Rule 485 motion requires a COA. And we can point you to what Pouncey says at the very last sentence. What Harbison makes clear is that a COA is no longer required for collateral appeals. But what we have here is not a collateral appeal.
Well, but then there's a comma, and it goes on to say, separate from appeals over the merits of the habeas petition.
Well,
does that not mean anything?
Well, wait. So 2 points, Your Honor. First, I don't think, as petitioner argued in his opening brief, that a COA can only be required for a petition that resolves the merits. It can be the proper reading here. He would be reading Harbison to effectively overrule Slack. And not only would it be anomalous...
But what about Judge Batchelder's question? Can you give a direct answer to the question she just asked before we go down a Slack you know, rabbit hole.
Well, we believe that Judge Sutton meant in Pouncey by saying on the merits is a case that it prevents the district court from adjudicating the merits any further. It doesn't actually have to be an order that is addressing the merits or resolves the merits. Otherwise, that would effectively overrule SLAC. And what petitioner wants this court to do more than just effectively overrule SLAC is to ask this court to effectively overrule its precedent requiring a COA for Rule 60B motions.
How's that?
Well, in 2007, this court said that a COA is required for Rule 60B motions. But
I mean,
petition-
certainly one that is treated as a second petition, itself being treated like, you know, a habeas petition presenting merits.
Well, what petitioner says in his opening brief is that it's distinguishable from Rule 4A5 motions because it touches on the merits. But after Gonzales v. Crosby, a Rule 60B motion cannot touch on the merits. Otherwise, it requires authorization from the circuit. And I don't think that there's any reason to draw a line there. I don't see how textually you can look at 2253C's text and read the final order to apply to a Rule 60B motion, but not the Rule 4A5 motion. They both text.
Can I go back to Sutton's opinion? It says, put another way, even though the federal courts may treat some habeas interlocutory orders as final decisions because they are completely separate from the merits of the action, that does not mean they dispose of the merits. So he says final decisions that are separate from the merits do not dispose of the merits.
And what we believe Pouncey is addressing are orders that are final under the collateral order doctrine, that they are addressing an entirely collateral issue. And they're only final under the collateral order doctrine because they necessarily must be separate from the merits, and they cannot have the effect of terminating the litigation. That's why the bail order in Pouncey was appealable at all.
I don't know where the government seems to have sort of some implied limitation to each of these points. I mean, like, where does that one arise from? The government believes that there's this implied limitation, that Judge Sutton was only talking about, what, like the Cohen orders, right? I mean, what's that doctrine? It's been a while.
The cloud.
Is that what you're saying?
That's what we believe.
And where does the government, divine that from?
When you look back at Harbison, what Harbison was addressing was an entirely collateral issue.
But did the court in any way invoke that fact in its reasoning?
No, but the court's decision should not be read expansively in light of that. Not one party, not even the federal government in Harbison, disputed that a COA was not required. There was no real significant briefing on the COA issue.
It's a dangerous thing in this line of work to, disregard what the court says. And the court there made a clear distinction between a final order in 1291 and the final order in the COA context.
Certainly, Your Honor. We're not asking the court to disregard the words in Harbison. Our approach reconciles this COA, the order denying the Rule 485 motion with Harbison, because what dispose of the merits means is that it has the effect of concluding the proceedings. And that points out exactly your distinction between a final order and the final order, because the order in Pouncey, a bail order denying bail pending the review of the habeas petition, was simply a final order during the context of the district court proceedings. It was not the final order entered in the district court's proceedings. It didn't have the effect of concluding the proceedings whatsoever.
So he files a 2255 petition with an IAC claim that he tried to bring to us on direct review, and we said, no, we're not going to do it now. Bring it as a 2255. So he does what we say, and he brings it as a 2255 pro se. District court disagrees with him, enters an order. I don't know if there was a judgment yet. Probably was a judgment, right? So there's a judgment. Judgments are, really important things in the context of appeals. So the district court enters a judgment. He gets put in the shoe. He doesn't file in time. And he comes to us. And so now the district court denies the motion for an extension. And you're saying that in this body of entries on the docket for 2255, you're saying the final order, and adding the Harbison gloss, disposing of the merits, the final order disposing of the merits is not the district court's judgment rejecting the 2255 on the merits. To the contrary, it's a district court judgment denying a motion for an extension. Is that the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's because...
how?
petitioner would have required a COA to appeal the order denying his Section 2255 motion if he had filed a timely notice of appeal. By failing to file a timely notice of appeal and having his extension request denied, this is the final.
Do you dispute that the judgment is the final order on the merits? Because he's got an order denying the motion to extend, but a judgment on the merits.
We believe that when you need to consider what the final order is, you look at the time of a given appeal. So there can be more than one the final order over the course of another a habeas proceeding.
I guess grammatically, I just fall off the wagon there. I mean, the government does not deal with this issue in its brief. The final order, the definite article. The petitioner makes that argument. And, you know, I mean, the is, it's not referring to any example within a certain type. It's referring to a particular example. You know, I drive a I drive a GTI. If I tell my wife, you know, the GTI had a flat tire, she knows which particular one I'm talking about. I'm not talking about any GTI. 1291 says a final order. There can be more than one. Any one that falls within that type is appealable. This is telling us to look for a particular example of something that's final. And it's hard for me to understand why that would be denying a motion for an extension as opposed to the judgment, which that's like, you know, the star in the center of the system here, which disposed of the merits. I mean, that's a real head scratcher.
4 points, Your Honor, and I will be quick.
That's all right. I think
I won't be quick. But yeah, the final order here is there's no question that this is the final order in this case. I understand that you might have concerns about more broadly other cases, but there's no question. This is the only order from which petitioner can appeal. The text of Section 2253 squarely encompasses this order. Second, this court has already implicitly adopted the understanding that there has to be more than one the final order in the course of a habeas proceeding. Otherwise, it could never have held that a COA was required for a Rule 60B motion.
I don't really see that, at least in a case where we are treating the 60B as a second petition. It's like it's not a 60B. In fact, you're seeking to file another 2254 or 2255 petition. The 60B is just kind of a misleading label in
those
cases.
Yeah, can I add to that? Because 60B has to be a final order, otherwise the exception will swallow the rule, whereas that isn't true in this case.
I don't think that that's true, Your Honor. I think that there's no suggestion that we should be parsing what type of Rule 60B motion has been brought. For instance, this court has said that a Rule 60B motion can be used for the exact same purpose as a Rule 4A5 order, to seek more time to file a timely notice of appeal. In that case, the petitioner would need a COA to appeal that type of Rule 60B order. In Tanner v. Eukins in 2015, this court said you can use a Rule 60B motion to seek more time to file a timely notice of appeal. What that would do is vacate the judgment, have the judgment reinstated, and trigger a new time to file a notice of appeal.
Did we say in that case that the denial of the, you know, extension for time, I guess, was the final order for purposes of this 2253?
No, Your Honor, that was not the context of whether or not a COA should be required there. But I think that there's no way to distinguish between.
Oh, I think we might be able to come up with something on that.
Well, let me just give you two other points on why I think that this has to be the final order. First of all, when Congress enacted AEDPA in 1996, it retained the language, the final order, that was already governing the COA requirement. And at that time, courts were already applying that language to orders other than the order denying the habeas petition. Congress was presumably aware of that at the time, and yet it still retained that language.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point, but it's also a fiction. And, I mean, for me, you know, set aside which approach creates more work. I think the government's does, but I'm not that worried about it. What I am worried about is the language, and I'm really hung up on the definite article here. It's telling me to look for one. And the judgment, when we're talking about things that are final, I mean, the judgment's like a black hole that just sucks everything in. You know, that's final.
What the court is going to do if it says that an order denying a habeas petition is the only one that requires a COA, it's going to mean that there's no COA required for any type of post-judgment motion moving forward.
Who's filing these things? I mean, you know, there's how many of these things are we going to get?
They're going to be significant. What the Supreme Court said in Bannister is that Rule 60B is one of the most popular filings, and this court is going to face a significant uptick in automatic appeals from post-judgment proceedings. And what petitioner doesn't...
I mean, I think we treat 60B different, and it makes sense, because that is on the merits under Harbison in a lot of ways. I understand you have some case that I'm going to have to go read from 2015, but set that aside for a second.
I don't understand how a Rule 60B motion in all circumstances is going to be on the merits. And then what petitioner is asking this court to do is to start distinguishing between Rule 60B motions.
Let me ask you this. Did you look at his chart? Because you're getting to the sufficiency point on page 6 of the reply brief.
Yes.
Do you agree with it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So where is it wrong?
Well, he is correct in that our approach would require more COA analyses. But what he is not acknowledging is that you cannot equate a full-blown appeal and a COA analysis. In this court, analysis...
Well, I understand. I think we know how to do COAs, and you have to answer that, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but go back for a second. Is the chart accurate in that every one of those, maybe one COA is easier than another, but is the chart accurate? As I recall it, I don't have it in front of me, but it's like 1-1-1-2 for you all.
The chart is accurate, but having more COA analyses is not an issue. First of all, a COA analysis only goes before one judge in the circuit. It doesn't go before a three-judge merits panel. It often doesn't come with full briefing. A notice of appeal under Rule 22B...
Sometimes. It usually gets sent to a three-judge, often after the one-judge part.
But it is certainly not the same analysis. It's abbreviated procedures that are intended to serve as a screening mechanism to protect this court's docket from the resources that go into...
I'll tell you, I mean, so we get a lot of... we get both sort of appeals from a Rule 4 type thing and COA orders on our motion docket. And, you know, if it's somebody who's saying they should have gotten an appeal, I mean, that's typically like one page. And it's just, there's not much to it. I think all of us up here have seen innumerable COA orders that go on for like, you know, at least 5 to 10 pages because the petitioner has so many claims. And just for the COA, the order has to labor their way through. No reasonable jurist could disagree, you know, over and over and over again. And those things are a lot more burdensome to have a multiplicity of.
I know I'm out of time, Your Honor, but if
that's
I just...
okay. I have no idea what the time is. We don't have the lights today, so...
Yeah.
But if I can quickly just respond
to
that.
Yeah, please. Then you can take 30 seconds to wind up.
Can I ask one question after that?
Yeah, and after his question, whatever.
Right,
go ahead.
Quickly, Your Honor. What petitioner suggests in his brief that it's going to be more burdensome is not necessarily true, and what Your Honor laid out about what you'd have to go through. Slack makes clear and Moody makes clear that this court will not necessarily ever have to wade into the constitutional merits question if the procedural ruling is itself not debatable. So that is a presumption that you're going to even have to reach that in the COA request. But Slack itself also addresses this concern. It says even for the simplest appeal of a statute of limitations question that you still need to look into the merits. And this analysis is going to be easier than a Slack. Because here you actually have an order addressing his Section 2255 motion to reference. And I do think that while Your Honor pointed out that in some cases a Rule 485 extension appeal might be more difficult, the COA analysis generally are abbreviated procedures. They are nothing like a full-blown appeal.
But believe me,
be on the other side.
We're intimately familiar with the COA procedures.
Yeah, they're not easy, at least in my mind. Okay, here's my question. I think I have to ask it. Okay, so, because I get one. If we accept paragraphs 2 and 5 of his little motion as true, A, is that good enough for good cause? And B, what case do you have for the proposition that he needed a verified affidavit?
I'm just looking at paragraphs
2 and 5.
Well,
I guess it's two questions in one. So 2 and 5 are the shoe and no postage stamps. So
during the time in which he was required to file his notice of appeal. That's just what it says.
This is not a question of whether or not those conditions might generally have constituted good cause. It's the fact that they were vague and insufficient about whether he was even in the shoe and subject to those conditions for the entire 60 days.
It says during the time in which he was required to file his notice of appeal. He's pro se. I mean, we're not going to, you know, I mean, give them the most uncharitable reading we can grammatically manage. The time during which he's required to file his notice of appeal. That means the 60-day period.
I don't read
doesn't
it that way, Your Honor.
I
read it
that
at
it
some
that way.
Point during
this
the 60
in prison,
days.
Pro se. I mean, shouldn't we read it that way?
Wait, here. And did you contest it below?
We did not take a position on the extension request.
Okay,
below,
so
but
wait, the way I treated things as a district judge is if one side says X is true and the other side didn't respond and didn't take a position, then I treat X as true, and what should walk us away from that? Because we have no evidence to the contrary.
What should walk you away from that is that nowhere in this motion did petitioner say that he was subject to these conditions for all 60 days. And under this court's case law, it is insufficient to allege that at some point during the filing window, you were unable to file notice of
appeal. He says, in particular, Mr. Missouri was denied access to postage stamps during the time in which he was required to file his notice of appeal.
We read that, Your Honor, to mean that at some point, in light of the other vague allegations in his motion, that at some point he was precluded.
But then why didn't you object below?
I've been informed by the U.S. Attorney's Office that we generally do not respond to motions unless ordered to do so by the district court. And so we
get to take this approach that you're taking every time the U.S. Attorney's Office files something that is a little bit sloppy or vague in its language.
I don't
That'll
think that
fun.
This is analogous to that situation here. What this court has said is that granting a Rule 4A5 extension should only be granted in extraordinary and unique circumstances. Petitioner has not proven here because he has both vague and conclusory allegations and unverified allegations.
He's a prisoner with a high school education, you know? I mean, it's harsh. This is harsh. What the denial in this reading is harsh. And that's just generally not the way we read pro se. He just wants an appeal. He went the way, you know, he did what we told him to. And now he just wants to get us to look at it.
This court has said in Martin v. Sullivan that there's no excuse under Rule 4A5 for pro se petitioners. And I think that makes sense.
Right, agreed. But we do read their stuff generously. Can it be construed in the manner that does meet the requirements? And here I would suggest that's actually the more natural reading.
No, I think the question really is whether it was an abuse of discretion to not read it that way, and I don't think
so. Wait, but the district court didn't even mention good cause.
But that's because he rejected the allegations at the outset before even applying the facts to any legal standard.
But then he says at the end of his order, he hasn't met his burden of establishing excusable neglect. And he, in his motion, says, I'm seeking it for good cause, not neglect. I wasn't neglectful. I couldn't get access to anything. That's not neglect.
But what petitioner failed to do was ever provide sufficient allegations, both they were vague and unverified, about whether he was even in the shoe and unable to file a timely notice of appeal.
You concede if I move for an extension for good cause and the government and the district court says, well, you haven't demonstrated excusable neglect, that the district court, by definition, committed an error of law?
I think that might be an error of law, but that's not in light of this.
Explain to me how it's not, because you say might.
Because what the district court did was, at the outset, deny the facts as insufficient. It never reached the point where it was applying the facts to the legal standard at all. And either way, even if this court were to find that was an abuse of discretion, we can give that, it would still be harmless. Because whether or not the district court interjected the words good cause next to excusable neglect, it would still have come out the same way. They would have.
It's sort of like if he had interjected the word entire before time, then we would be able to say that he did what he needed to do, right?
It would have been a closer question, but I will flag something that what petitioner suggested when speaking to your honors, he suggested that what was missing was simply information he was in the shoe all 60 days. Being in the shoe itself is not a reason to grant an extension. A prisoner must comply with filing a timely notice of appeal.
Tough to file from the shoe. Can I ask you where that says, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the order denying. Where do you say he does at the outset say, I'm denying it because whatever you just said?
We read that from his statement that what he says is Missouri has not supported his allegations. He then says that Missouri has not filed an affidavit or verified statement. And then he
That's
flags,
at the end, though, right?
Well, that's the only substantive paragraph explaining the difference.
But that paragraph starts that he has not met his burden of establishing excusable neglect. Isn't that the same paragraph, or are you reading a different one?
That is the same paragraph, Your Honor. But even if the words good cause followed excusable neglect, the district court would have reached the same conclusion that the facts were insufficient. And even if this...
How do we know that?
Because the facts did not show that petitioner had been in the SHU and subject to the conditions of being denied access to the law library and postage for the entire 60 days.
But he doesn't say that as his reason.
But he does say, Your Honor, that Missouri has not supported his allegations, and then he provides several reasons for that.
Because he didn't provide a verified complaint. So that's my final question. I only had one, but I've used a lot more. My final question is, do you have a case for that?
We don't, Your Honor, but we do think that in light of the fact that the allegations are vague, and then in addition unverified, that together certainly was not a clear error of judgment to
deny. But you don't have a case.
There's no case in this court holding that either an affidavit is required or not required.
Okay. Judge Batchelder, any further questions?
No. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Cohen, you've vigorously
Your
represented the government in this case.
Thank you
for your argument. We'll hear from Mr. Snido.
Oh, there it is. Now we got light.
Yeah. Restore order here.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Keep my co-panelists under control here.
Begin with the text. I agree with you, Judge Kethledge, that some meaning has to be given to the definite article in the statute itself. However, if there's any doubt on that from the rest of the panel, I mean, we have Harbison, and more recently we have Pouncey.
But what about her argument that this is the final order in this case, and it does ultimately, in some sense, dispose of the merits because it culminates the case?
That is just a coincidence of the specific facts here that will not be true in every case, and I'll give you a few examples. For example, if the district court imposes sanctions on the petitioner, which has happened before, that order will come later in time. Even then, the motion for the extension of time, it'll be the last order in the case, but it's impossible to characterize the order denying sanctions as the final order in the case. And that wouldn't make any sense, right? And let me give you another reason why. If it's true that this time extension order is the final order or the final decision under like a classic 1291, then under the usual rule, you get to appeal every single prior order, right? So if that's the final judgment that my client's appealing, then in theory, he's entitled to appeal the 2255 denial just by appealing the time extension. That can't be right because obviously he didn't appeal that order. It also can't be right because of Bowles v. Russell. Like, those time limits are jurisdictional. And if he doesn't have an order saying that he can file in time, it's at least arguably doesn't have jurisdiction. So that's why it can't be the final order. On Slack versus McDaniels, I've said what I said except for one more wrinkle, which is that if my client had his habeas petition denied on procedural default grounds rather than on the merits as he did here, right? So assume the district court just denied on procedural default, then the facts are the same. He files his time extension motion. Well, what's the COA analysis look like in that case? We're going to imagine what three different hypothetical reasonable jurists would have thought about three different orders, the order denying the time extension, the order on procedural default, and then the underlying merits. I mean, at some point, we should just cut to the chase and decide the time extension motion. The Sixth Circuit case regarding Rule 60 is from 2007, which is before Harbison. It's U.S. v. Hardin.
It's not the 2015 one she cited?
What's the 2015 one from the Sixth Circuit?
Yes, that's what I thought she said.
On Rule 60? Hold on.
I don't know where my notes are now. Well, you don't remember.
If you got it, I'm happy to answer questions on it. But United States versus Hardin is from 2007. That's before Harbison. I think, you know, at least before Harbison, perhaps it was more debatable. But after Harbison, and more particularly after Pouncey, it's clear you have to give some meaning to the term merits, and there's no way to connect the time extension order to the merits of this case. Under the collateral order doctrine, I mean, I read Pouncey as saying that if the order is a collateral order, then it definitely doesn't require a COA. I don't read it the other way to say if this doesn't count as a collateral order under Cohen, then it does require a COA. However, what I want to point out is that it's actually unclear whether Rule 4A5 motions are being appealed under the collateral order doctrine or under what I'll call traditional 1291. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because it's all the same statute, right? It's just 1291.
It's kind of both. You know,
it's kind of both.
It's collateral to the merits, but it's also there's nothing left to do.
That's right. The awkward point is that it's not interlocutory, but I'll give you a couple of cases if you want confirmation on that. One is In Re Diet Drugs from the Third Circuit, which is 401 F3rd 143. And what that case holds was that the Rule 4 motion could be appealed even though there was no final judgment in the case. And actually, the court went on to dismiss the merits appeal because there's no final judgment. And if that's true, then the Rule 4 motion had to be appealed under a collateral order posture.
Give me that site again.
Yes, ma'am. It's 401 F3rd 143.
You said it's Third Circuit?
It's the Third Circuit from 2005.
Not binding.
It's not binding. There isn't any Sixth Circuit. First of all, there's very little case law theorizing on under what font of authority you're appealing a Rule 4A motion. It's definitely 1291. whether it's real 1291 or Cohen 1291 is less clear. Let me give you one more case on this, which is Diamond versus United States District Court. That's a Ninth Circuit case from 1981. That's 661 F2nd 1198. What happened there was the court said, and I'll quote, Rule 4 motions are appealable whether the motion seeks leave to file a late appeal from a final judgment or from an order which falls within the collateral order exception. So if that's true, I mean, if you're using a Rule 4 motion to try to get more time to appeal a collateral order, there's no final judgment, that Rule 4 motion has to be being appealed as a collateral order anyway. I don't think you need to get that far, but it's clear from Pouncey that if you can say this order was collateral, then there's definitely no COA required. That's definitely what Judge Sutton said. And I think it is fair to characterize this under the collateral order doctrine because all the requirements are satisfied, right? Did it just finally...
All right, before you start going down some other point, let me ask you a question since we've got the red light on.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you say I'm looking at your conclusion. You say we should reverse the district court's denial of the motion to extend time, in which case the district court would have to grant him that time, and so he would file a notice of appeal, which would be deemed timely. But then at what point, I mean, he would need a COA then. At what point does that happen? Did the district court make any determination? A district court has authority to grant him one, right?
COA?
Yeah.
The district court determined on the underlying habeas petition?
On the 1255, or 2255.
Denied.
Denied a COA on it. Okay, all right. So then he would have to come to us and ask for a COA, kind of pursuant to the notice of appeal. I'm trying to understand. It's
so in this case, it would be more work on your efficiency point rather than less, just to be fair. But it would be a case-by-case determination. In other words, you're assuming most 4A5 appeals will be frivolous, and so we can deny them quickly. But if we grant, we do the work to grant and the COA.
Well, okay. Let me answer that. Let me just clarify the procedural thing before I forget. Mm-hmm. Everything you said was true, Judge Kethledge, except that my client filed a notice of appeal with the time extension motion, so I think the district court could just deem that one to
have. Okay, I see.
Other than that, everything you said is correct. When he tries to appeal the 2255, he'll need a COA.
So would this case actually go back to the district court, or would it just remain here?
I'm not sure. I think the easiest way to do it would be to...
I mean, the district court's already denied a COA.
It would remain. We'd have to decide the COA question.
You do have to decide the COA question, but...
Because he wanted a hearing. The district court didn't give him a hearing. He said he had witnesses. District court says, no, you lose on the leader enhancement.
Yeah.
And district court says, no COA.
Yeah.
What are we sending it back to a district judge for?
I think that's a fine way of handling it, reversing. And then he'd be entitled to, of course, different briefing than the ones I filed, which were in a different
briefing. Yeah, I mean, the briefing in this appeal didn't reach that.
Right.
If the case went that route.
But that seems...
But it stays with us.
It could stay with you.
Yeah.
However, I want to say on the efficiency point real quick. I mean, it's true that to the extent that you grant the time extension, eventually you have to do the COA. But notice that you only have to do it one time, whereas under the government's rule, you do it now, and then you do it again later.
That's your two.
That's our two. And if it's slack, it's three. And
right, you know what it means when the judges start doing
yes,
this?
Yes, yes, yes.
Case is over.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Argument's over. All right, thank you both for your arguments. And I know you were, Mr. Snydell, appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act, and you've done an exemplary job, both sides, in presenting briefing and argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge Thapar, for the appointment. My wife in particular wants to thank you for the appointment. She loves extra work. Thank you.
All right, whatever that means. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.